Today's talk, given by Dr. Vanessa Lawrence, CB. Her talk is entitled, as you can see, Location, Its Role in Solving Issues Facing You, Our Nation and Our World. Dr. Vanessa Lawrence is working internationally as a senior advisor to governments, intergovernmental organisations, including the World Bank, and large private sector organisations. In addition, she is a director of Location International Limited, providing strategic advice globally to public and private sectors, and particularly as to the use of location to enhance decision making. Vanessa is also a non-executive director of the Satellite Applications Catalogue, which is good as I was hoping to bring them into the programme. And their focus is fostering innovation in the use of satellite data, which is also the honorary colonel of 135 Geographic Squadron Royal Engineers, and holds numerous advisory or trustee roles at things such as the Ardent Big Data Centre, Winchester Science Centre, RGS, Geographical Association, and is also an adjunct professor at the University of Southampton and is a professor at Kingston, and as well as other things such as very nice patron of the Cure Parkinson's Trust and Map Action. Some of you will know Map Action. And as many of you, but not all of you perhaps, will know, from 2000 to 2014, Vanessa held the post of Director General and CEO of Orient Survey, for instance, National Mapping Agency, or Authority. And over that very probable time for the organisation, became the longest serving Director General and CEO of Orient Survey since 1875. Other roles have included work in the UN and previously senior roles at Autodesk and Google Media Company Pearson. So, after all that, I think that the above speaks for itself, and therefore I need not tell you we couldn't wish for a better opening speaker than Vanessa Lawrence. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and I'm absolutely delighted to be here. I'm also delighted that I know we've got a mixture of the NSC courses, other students who are studying here in the school, in the institute, but also we've got students from across the university. So thank you all for deciding on a Friday to come. So I thought that was fantastic. I would have been kind of suitably impressed if it had been half the book on a Friday afternoon. So this is great. Anyway, over the next sort of 45 minutes, what I'm hoping is to give everybody good insight as to how location really is making a difference around the world, and how if you are studying it or you are thinking of going into this as a profession, and you might do that from everything from engineering through to data science and computer science, through to obviously being in geography, then, you know, it's a career that you might think about. So there are some very simple things to remember. And the first one is everything happens somewhere. And as long as you remember that, you suddenly realize how important location is. Because every other piece of data can be attached to it, so that you start to understand what's happening in a particular place. And as a result, we can see that where underpins all of our daily lives, whether it's when you got up this morning and how electricity is supplied to you in your home, or whether it's how your mobile phone is working, absolutely it does underpin everything we do. Through to how your rubbish is collected. I can assure you here in the United Kingdom, rubbish is collected using geospatial information. It's driven huge efficiency in rubbish collection, but it also underpins all of our emergency services. But around the world, it's also becoming one of the key things that governments and major decision makers are realizing it really can help modernize economy. It used to be that people would be, particularly in cabinets, which I'm lucky enough to spend a lot of time addressing around the world, used to be that they would be interested in their financial profile, and they'd be particularly interested in their monetary performance based on statistics. But if you basically viewed the next image and just looked at it statistically, you wouldn't absolutely understand what's going on. So that is, you know, a very kind of diverse neighbourhood where if you were thinking about the population per square kilometre, you would struggle to understand that population at all. Here we have basically, you know, unmade roads, just kind of mud roads, and here you've got very modern urban living, high value, against what, you know, is certainly not low value housing in the majority of the world, that, you know, in the whole world. It's certainly not informal housing, but it is certainly not high grade housing, but it is high density housing. And so, you know, we learn a lot the moment you start to think about location. We also now live in a world where location can help us understand incidents with immediate effect. And here is Houston last month, basically, where we're understanding what has happened very quickly and being able to compare between the two in an instant. And so decision makers are able to consider what action they need to take. Now, many of us, kind of, when you think of geography, particularly for those that aren't studying necessarily here, you'll think about maps. And I love this little extract, which was from a 1942 book, which if you haven't read, it's worth having a look at, West with the Night. A map says to you, read me carefully, follow me closely, doubt me not. It says, I am the earth in the palm of your hand. Without me, you are alone and lost. And indeed you are. Were all the maps in the world destroyed and vanished under the direction of some malevolent hand, each man would be blind again. Each city be made a stranger to the next. Each landmark become a meaningless signpost pointing to nothing. Now, I very much, when I read that, think of a country that I had to go to because they wanted my advice, because they were scared of releasing their maps, even just basic map information, to their population, because their view was that many of the population wouldn't want to live where they live once they knew there were other places to live in the country. You know, what an interesting world we live in, that as recent as in the last 10 years, there are governments and countries that want geography to remain hidden so that knowledge is remaining, in their opinion, not is hidden. I arrived, and I must admit, the first briefing I went to, which was supposed to brief me to practically tell me what I should be telling them, and I listened hard, and knew what was already on my laptop, because what I'd already done was downloaded from outside the country, and then I went back to my hotel and used various techniques to see whether I could obtain it via their internet as well, and 90% of it I could by various means. I was able to show that absolutely mapping was available. People already probably knew this. And wouldn't it be better if they allowed more accurate 50,000 scale data to be available for their country rather than inaccurate, less definitive mapping? And in the end, that's what they did. But it took showing them what's available for them to realise the importance. Actually, I'm just getting over one of those cops. Also, we are very lucky, and the next slide is with permission of my former employer, Ordnance Survey, that we have extremely accurate mapping here in the UK. And in England, Scotland and Wales, we have something called the Master Map of Great Britain, and essentially it's basically shows every feature on the landscape within the specification, and they make more than 10,000 changes to the Master Map of Great Britain every day. So we are very lucky because we do not have hidden geography. There is nothing that's hidden. It was a case 20 years ago, there were things that were not on the map, but now everything's on the map. And and that was a decision made by the Cabinet Office some years ago. But of course, we now live in a world where satellite data can so easily assist us to understand what's going on. Even in countries where there's poor mapping, out-of-date mapping, very quickly you can start to understand what is going on there. And for instance, I'm doing a lot of work, I'm leading one of the teams regarding the bailout of behalf of the international institutions. They're my employer in this work, but helping the Greek government. And in Greece, they have got very out-of-date mapping for all kinds of reasons. But we were able to show them very quickly that there is a lot of up-to-date information that they can then build on going forward. In Europe, we're very lucky because there's been a huge investment by those countries that contribute to the European Space Agency in what's now called the Copernicus Programme and used to be called GMES. And as a result, there is coming on stream and the data is already coming down and it is freely available for people to use. Basically, a lot of global information. Our biggest problem is how to process so much of it. There are economic benefits of this kind of data. And, you know, these are obviously socio-economic benefits, and we'll talk a little bit later about these kind of studies, because there's been a lot of studies that say, if you do this, the benefits to the economy is this. But it's only this year have we now got one that shows that the benefits, the true benefits of the economy that have been measured and seen the net results, rather than just economists doing their excellent work but predicting what will happen. Because with the Copernicus program, it says for every €1 spent by the European taxpayer on Copernicus, the public return is €10, can be expected. And there are a lot of those kind of statements in our industry where people say there's a lot of benefits to come. But the key thing is, can we ever measure and monitor them? And I'll talk a little bit about the one place that that has happened. Now, we live in a world where the internet has changed everything we do. And absolutely, that, you know, whatever figures you get, what you know is there's more data being made every second, and analysing it and keeping up with it is very hard. And this kind of setup is what's changing our industry, because many, many people are now realising you can get a better understanding of the data that's around you the moment you add that dimension of place. But we must consider that around the world, everywhere is not like here. And I was visiting this office less than 2 weeks ago in the country, and, you know, there was a computer. It wasn't on. Why? Well, the electricity was down. Had been down for 20 hours, actually. And anyway, it wasn't really what was the main thing. And they did a lot of hand scribing there. So, you know, it shows that we mustn't universally believe that the world we have in our hands, whether it's in our kind of handheld devices that I guarantee every single one of us has now, that is not the world that the majority of the world is living in. Now, we're kind of lucky in this country because we live in a community where, first of all, our data is available. It can be available at a cost, or it can be available for free. But also, our government has been quite pioneering in making sure that there are data sets which everyone can use, whether they're geospatial data sets or data sets for all kinds of things. And if you've never looked at data.gov.uk, I recommend you do, because, you know, you may find in whatever research you're doing, it might have something that's of interest. We also live in a world where absolutely informal mapping is very much used by us all to get us around, to do things that we want to do in our lives, and we're happy with it, it's there or thereabout. We then have, you know, high resolution imagery, and this is again courtesy of Gordon and Survey, but where absolutely we do have assets which people have determined are definitive for the country. And then we have, at every minute of every day, satellite information coming over our country. And you know, you've probably realised this is all the same geography I've been showing you, and it's Oxford Street in London. And so you can get different lenses of different information to do different things at all times. And whether you're just planning your own journey, where you probably use some informal mapping, Apple Maps, Google Maps, or whatever, or whether you're running the emergency services, you will be using probably nowadays a combination of this kind of data. As I pointed you out, data.gov.uk, in the mapping section, it says there are, as at this afternoon, there were 2,269 different data sets you can look at. Now, I knew somebody would be in the audience who it's directly targeted at, because I'm a bit puzzled, but I suspect it's been a recategorization has caused this. But today, under mapping, is 269, whereas when I last looked, which was the 10th of October 2016, 5,139. So I leave that for you, because I know that will puzzle you as to what exactly has been going on. But many countries don't have resources like that at all. Here was the view from my bedroom window in Addis Ababa about 5 weeks ago. And, you know, you can understand the difficulty of mapping such informal areas, and that many countries don't have mapping resources such as we need to make those decisions. If we are to make a difference to the globe, we need to bring everybody into being able to use good resources to underpin their governments. And I certainly have seen the benefit that governments gain from using good geospatial information. This you will recognise as the cabinet room of number 10, and that I believe is Mr Cameron, and he was at the time looking at a brief I had done, and that was about flooding. And because when something like flooding happens, governments really do need to react, because the population does not like it that their own houses have been affected, and they want to understand what government is doing for it. And a very good example happened some time ago in, this must have been about 2011, I think. This was in Australia, when there was catastrophic flooding in basically East Coast Australia. And the big problem was that in Australia at that time, they had a law that said that each person who was badly flooded would receive an immediate payment if their house had a particular level of flooding. Forget what it was, but I think it was about 7 centimetres. So if you had 7 centimetres of water in your house, the government would pay out. Well, that's fantastic. If you've got 20 or 30 houses, you can send a surveyor out, they can measure it, you get your payment. If you've got tens of thousands of houses, what are you going to do as a government? What is the pressure on you to respond? People want to know. And so, using geographical information, very quickly, basically a new way of looking at it was designed, which was to basically plot all the debris lines within sort of literally a few hours, and then to publish them on the web, and be able to very quickly be able to say, if your house is within a debris line, then you are going to be paid out automatically. And if not, then you should put in a claim. And so it immediately empowered all the population to realise they were being paid out. and made sure the government was seen to be successful and responding. So there are many times when governments are absolutely use geographical information to make a difference. The next two slides are courtesy of a guy called Dr. Lee. Dr. Lee is the head of survey and mapping in China. And he's also tremendously interesting because he's also the person who sits far away from the premier of China whenever there is the very large assemblies, because he's also the head of one of the eight parties that help shape the laws, as he puts it. He's head of the Farmers' Party. So he's a very powerful man. But he always uses this slide. Digital China plus geospatial monitoring plus geospatial information industry equals leading country. Well, how powerful can you be? That shows how important it is. And certainly they always put geospatial information within their five-year plans. Now, we're all aware in everything we read about that there is acute population growth. And there are some good things and some bad things. The good thing is that since 1990, the number of people living on less than $1.25 a day was significantly reduced by 700 million, mainly in China and Asia. Now, the metric has been changed slightly to say that it's unacceptable that anyone lives on less than $1.9 a day. And there are still 700 million people. Just think about that. 10 times the population of the whole of the United Kingdom, 10 times that, live on less than $1.9 a day. So that's why I'm able to say that housing you saw wasn't informal housing. That's kind of average housing in lots of places. And basically, we still have people living in appalling conditions. And very much what we're seeing is geographical phenomena happening all the time, that people are moving to the cities. What we're seeing is over a billion people live in slums to be nearer jobs in the hope of getting jobs. In some of the countries I work, I get up early just to remind myself why I too am sometimes having a rubbish day. Because my rubbish day is because I might not have brilliant working conditions. I might not have quite the food I want. But if I go around the corner and watch people from 3 or 4 in the morning queuing for a job, queuing in the vain hope that they'll eat for the day, it makes me work a little bit harder. And bluntly, what I'm seeing is many governments are absolutely accepting that geospatial information is one of the key things that will help them move to understand where they can make better interventions, and together with the organisations, the world organisations that can help. We've known for a long time that our industry helps depict things, whether it be urban growth in Las Vegas between 1973 and 2000, or whether it's when you're looking at Kigali in Rwanda. Now, Rwanda's really interesting because Rwanda, some of us are old enough to know. If you're not old enough to know, then just flick on the internet and have a quick look. That in the last 30 years, they had the most horrendous and destructive genocide. And it was just like we see every night, we hear about the terrible things going on in Syria, obviously just been happening coming out of Myanmar. Basically, that was the situation we saw in Rwanda every night on our news. So who could have imagined that fast forward, you know, and they are becoming very sophisticated users of geospatial information. The government decided that it was a key differentiator. And I have to say our own government has assisted this. But one of the key things was they decided that they needed to start to build layers of information. And one of the layers they did was build very strongly was their land tenure, land ownership. Now, they could have spent 30 to 50 years doing it. In one of the countries I work at the moment, they've already spent, I think, well, they started in the 1990s to try and improve the situation, and they're only probably 20% into it. But Rwanda decided to do it for fit for purpose, because they were in a situation where, in general, women stayed at home, and home was their patch of land. Why? Because land theft was so great. And people literally would, if somebody left the land, they would have plonked themselves there by nightfall. And they would also steal the livestock on it. And this was just always going on. So habitually, men went to try and get work, and women stayed on the land, and guess what they did? They kept their children at home. So there was only about a very small percentage of children going to school. So by basically changing the profile of land ownership, and they did this in a very modern way, which they will improve over time, but they managed to register between 2009, where they only had 40,000 land parcels registered to an owner, they moved to having 10.6 million land parcels by 2014. And what this did was reduce conflict, allow people to now leave the land, and absolutely put children into school. And so it has completely changed the whole way people work, and also what it's done is assist people. They can now have long-term investment in their land, and they can start microfinancing. So very much geography has been a key change for them. And it also now only takes 28 days to transfer land, whereas when they only had 40,000 land parcels, it was taking up to a year. Now, geography can be quantified as to whether it really benefits nations. And here is a good example given by well-known Australian, where he talks about that when you start to think about land, the size of the Australian economy, he was saying in November 2014, was £1 trillion pounds per annum, and basically then he was talking about the loans secured against those land titles. And then he was looking at the total value of real estate. But the geographical information asset, the geography that underpins this, benefits the national economy by about £2.9 billion per annum. So when you start to quantify, you start to realise why governments like this. And at the same time, you can't do some of the things you want to do, like smart cities, unless you start to understand what is going on. But equally, in the world we're living in, it's no longer the state that necessarily is driving the change. We see that in satellites with Elon Musk, now going to go to Mars, we hear, as of today, but being pioneering, whereas it used to always be satellites were owned by governments. Now, within the next 4 months, you will see Britain have its own satellite constellation for the first time, and we'll talk about that later on, but absolutely it's not owned by the government. The government might be a user of it, but they are not going to own it. And what we've seen is, even though I know they're having a bit of a bad day at the moment, Uber, but Uber is playing a major role in geographical information around the world now. They obviously have been reusing some of the data that they have been acquiring as we are booking our rides with them, and they're repurposing it and turning themselves into a data company. And this is kind of quite interesting, and making big corporate sales into how people should run cities better and how people should use volume traffic information better. So what used to be a state-run entity is often turning into a private entity selling back to the state. At the same time, we're seeing at the highest levels people realising the importance that geospatial information, where this is at the UN, and he was the deputy to Ban Ki-moon, and he's saying geospatial information is fundamental to decision making, policy formulation, measuring and monitoring development elements, all critical to the post-2015 Sustainable Development Agenda. Now, I don't know how many of you have heard of the Sustainable Development Goals, but they are what's going to be very much at the forefront of many things when you decide to leave university and you go to work. Now, you may say, no, it won't be. I can assure you, whether I'm in London or whether I'm in difficult parts of the world, everybody is talking about the Sustainable. It's the measure on how we will continue to transform our world and how we will work harder to basically reduce that inequality that we see today with 700 million people living on less than $1.9 a day. And I and a colleague were lucky enough to be involved in the drafting of this. I have to say it's a very large document. I only got four words in, so it's not wasn't a big coup, but we did get about Earth observation and geospatial information into the understanding of these documents. Now you may say, I'm not so sure I'll ever need to know about the Sustainable Development Goals. It doesn't matter whether you're going to work for, well, I recently had a board of a bank who believes that they should run their values more to do with the Sustainable Development Goals and underpinning it with location. So we are seeing this getting into everybody. And the one thing we do know is that you can't really measure and monitor anything without knowing where it is. It goes back to everything happens somewhere. My first phrase to you. And so if you need to measure and monitor sustainable development, you do need to have location and geography. So again, it's another reason why people need to invest in this, in order to make these Sustainable Development Goals really transform people's lives for 2030. And what we can see is there's lots of ways that we can all connect. And there are 17 goals, just in case you didn't know, and then there are lots of indicators, but let's not go into the mechanisms of how this has been thought up. It's been signed off by our Prime Minister, signed off by every Prime Minister of the 194 affected countries. And so everybody, whether you be in the Middle East, the Far East, or in London, everybody has a Sustainable Development Goal unit now within their government to make sure they are meeting some of these things. And even for Britain, we're going to struggle because some of the things that are being asked, we haven't been recording our data that way. But what we can see is that geospatial information, locational information, is very relevant to every aspect of the Sustainable Development Goal. And what we can see is that at any time, whether you're looking at the oceans, the land, or how people operate, i.e. education, cities, very much geography is going to be key to all of them. And what we then can see is taking the global picture, basically everything we do in when we create our geography, which for those who are not studying geographical sciences here, may not have come across this word before, but a national spatial data infrastructure. Basically, this is the way we in the world we live in now think of maps. We don't ever anymore think of them as sort of 2D, 1D maps on a piece of paper. We think of them as data and different layers. We'll come on a little bit more to that. But what we know is that we can connect that with data, whether it be social data about society or gender or employment, population, economic data or environmental data, and then we can relate them to the 17 goals of the Sustainable Development Goals. And very much with that work of the 17 Development Goals, and I've now moved from the UN to the World Bank, and with the twin goals of the World Bank, which is to end extreme poverty by 2030, and basically to promote shared prosperity, we can now see that basically there is a chance that as long as you use the where, you really can start to understand, you know, what is going on. This is Nairobi. I took this picture quite recently, and absolutely you can see the kind of difficult times people are having as they move into these urban environments. What we're also seeing, though, is that already there have been pioneering moves to use geospatial information to start to help countries understand what's going on. And you may be surprised, you may be delighted, you may be shocked, really, but the British have led, not the military, a civilian organisation you could work for that's actually around the Guildford area. They have been helping through the Asian Development Bank and the World Bank, they've been the advisors on helping Afghanistan have its now geospatial policy, and it was published last week. But they started this work, they're called ALSIS, they started this work some time ago when people started to invest into aid agencies into Afghanistan post the conflicts as there was a rebuilding of Afghanistan. And we're all probably aware it's pretty dangerous to go there. Every time somebody suggests I need to go to Kabul, I just haven't quite got there yet. You know, I really take my hat off to people who have gone. But basically, one of the things was the British government put £1 million into per year to assisting greenhouse development to try and assist the local population to stop growing, poppies, and to grow more cash crops that would be suitable to trade. And so they basically put these greenhouses in, and what they've been able to do is between 1 year and the next, so the you probably can't read this, but basically if you look, basically the darker green ones are effective ones, and the when there's red, orange ones are ones that are not operating, and red are when they've been destroyed. You start to understand a little bit more about what's happening, and also it helps you understand where it can be used as a proxy of, you know, perhaps people haven't got the message, and maybe that's bad news, and maybe up here it's good news, and all of these have been abandoned, so what's really going on there? So people can start to learn remotely about what's possible and can then do it in many different areas. You also can use this for looking at where would you put in an intervention, and here they looked at along this corridor for a candidate for what would be a soft project intervention. They basically had the quality of the agriculture, the proximity to rivers, the access to electricity, the lighter colour meaning there was electricity, and the proximity to roads. And very soon we're able to look at where might there be best, if you were going to do some intervention, you might think of doing it in these two areas. Another use has been in looking at how you can change people's working practices with very small amounts of technology. And here is two British companies, WeatherSafe and EarthEye. Basically, they've worked in Rwanda again, looking at how can you increase the value to the smallholder of their coffee. So basically 60% of all coffee is actually produced by people who live on less than $1.9 a day. If they have better weather data, better understanding of the health of their crop, then they can improve the quality of their coffee. Low quality coffee gets $1 per kilo, high quality can get up to $40 per kilo. So basically they installed web apps and various mobile apps, and they were able to see a 20 to 40% improvement in farmer income using that technology and help them in the supply chain. So basically having a direct impact on some of those people. Now, our world is very much now a complex world. It used to just be about mapping. And you'd have cartographers, you might have some people who flew over things, but geography is now being collected by us all in so many different ways. High altitude birds, satellites, drones, social media, and then commercial companies. Ooh, I don't need to log in to the university. So, what we also see is, I'm sorry, cable seems to have made things jump, is that the use of geospatial is now very much understood by leaders. And here is the really, well, he's this guy, Ede, who I know very well. He's one of, in my opinion, one of the world's best leaders. He is also the person who really was one of the driving forces, because he also had some money to give, to the Paris Climate Change meeting. And he led it on behalf of the World Bank. And he says, the use of geospatial information provides great opportunities to accelerate development of nations and address global, national and local challenges. But no longer are even more sophisticated maps needed, but the development of spatial data infrastructures required to underpin all decision-making in countries. So he very much sees a paradigm shift from flat maps to multi-dimensional maps, with totally interoperable frameworks where you'll have some base fundamental data, and then you'll have lots of thematic geodata. And what I see is all around the world, countries now building, sometimes in association with the private sector, sometimes no longer state-owned. Basically, they are building their fundamental themes, and they're doing the best they can. So often, they've had massive duplication, and I'll talk about that in a moment. But we talked about, is geodata valuable? And I said earlier, there'd been lots of economic studies, but there has now been published the first study that's seen it all the way through, and the summary is available in English. It's been done by Denmark, and what they did was they measured their last year when they basically were selling their geodata for the whole country, and then they basically looked at it each year with Pricewaterhouse basically auditing each and every year the change to the economic value. So it's been very interesting because there's always been lots of studies, but there have never been anyone who's seen it all the way through. And I had my good friend Thorben, who's the Deputy Director General, came to one of the countries I'm working in to explain how they got their efficiency gains and what they've done. But remember, they are, you know, we always must remember when you're talking these things that no country's the same. They have large swathes of rural areas, not as densely populated as others, so you may not get the same. So you mustn't say this would be the same for every country, but it shows. But what we are seeing with this advent of everybody interested in that spatial data infrastructures, we're seeing people really wanting to start planning them differently. And this is the kind of things that I present to cabinets. Now, it used to be geospatial data was technology led, and people would talk about, do you have this system or do you have that system? And then they'd say, and I got my data from. But it's all different now. And what's kind of interesting is when you're talking at Prime Minister level, is I often ask them about their financial strategy. Because I actually sat in front of one cabinet about 10 weeks ago where this cabinet said, yes, we're not quite sure why you're here because we don't think we need you. And I said, oh, okay, well, I'm perfectly, I got requested by, you know, your government to come, so I'm quite happy not to be here. And they said, yes, yes. And this was the deputy prime minister at the prime minister's cabinet meeting. So it was all a bit embarrassing. I'd been told I'd got 20 minutes, so I just said, well, you know, I don't know whether you need me at all, but I'd like to ask you a question before we get into geospatial and mapping. How do you run your money here in your country? And the head of the Treasury said, well, we have a financial strategy. We have a monetary policy committee and we have this and that and the other. And I went, excellent. I said, you have just said you do not need, because you've bought a countrywide license of a piece of software. I said, you've said you don't need geospatial because of that. I said, so does SAP really run your financial strategies? Of course not, that's just a tool. And then he looked at me and went, oh, perhaps we do need a geospatial strategy. Because they were just talking about this technology piece. And it's perfectly fine, you know, people make decisions to have open systems, to use proprietary systems. But the key thing that's most important is the organizational area. This is the area that needs strengthening, making sure you're using the global standards. I've recently come across a huge power company who'd created all their own standards that never even heard our industry. And then you need some data, which you can get from lots of different places, but the people element has to be developed. So organisational standards and people are becoming the areas that are holding us back as industries. And we're able to look at how mature, people are often interested in how mature is their geospatial data infrastructure. And, you know, is it non-existent or are they a bit ad hoc? And many countries then compare where they are here and where they need to be and come out very much looking at where they are as is and how they could actually improve through a new strategy to implementing things. Because this is the truth for one country. They have 18 different definitive road networks. 18 ministries say they are the definitive road network. One country, there's 14 definitive coastlines. They've had more shipping accidents than one cares to matter. They can't share anything because they've all built their own standards as well. And, you know, what you get is people saying, that's our definitive border. Oh, obviously not. Oh, well, we were thinking of having a dispute. And I go, I wouldn't have one if I were you, because nobody's even decided where it is. So you can look at sort of, you know, this as-is analysis, which you can find out, and you can compare it with international best practice from different countries, always of similar nature, don't go doing it with other people. And you can find key strategies and policies, and then grade yourself as a country. And a lot of people are now using this. It very much works in the same way many things, of where it's free of charge to use in lots of different ways. And it helps people to then think, well, we're here with our data, and we want to be there, so what do we need to do? So, just to finish, I wanted to talk a little bit about the future, because I've talked about how countries and governments, the private sector, are all using this geospatial information. I can assure you, I'm finding boards of very large companies not natural users of geospatial, and now you wanting to use geospatial. But we, in this room, if you're interested in geospatial, you know, there's a few guarantees. Absolutely, a lot of people will want you if you're well trained. The second thing is, though, they may not identify with you that what you do is what they need, because they're coming at it from different ways. I was recently asked to go into one of the oldest and one of the largest investment banks in the world. And They have populated themselves with data scientists to assess investment propositions and have just thought they might need to add a bit of Google Maps to it. When they discovered there was a whole industry behind this and what they could do, they are very excited. But they didn't know. So it's about, you know, finding out what people need. What we're also seeing is many new people entering our market. And we're seeing the machine learning companies absolutely fascinated by geospatial information, for everything from running autonomous vehicles through to processing this huge amount of data that's now available, whether it be imagery data or statistical data or whatever it is. We're also seeing many new companies coming in, and you know, you wouldn't have thought they could really make money. And then you start to think again and think, of course they can make money. And I don't know, does anyone know what that is a map of in 4 hours?
Internet.
No, it's and I can make it all live and drill down. Basically, it's mobile phone usage. So why am I interested in it is not the reason that most people are interested in it. Most people are really interested in the fact that around the Beltway, for instance, of Washington, D.C., you can see in the higher value areas, everyone's using an Apple device, and others in the lower value places, they're using a Samsung, which in America, as opposed to here in Europe, there is that sort of socioeconomic divide, whereas there isn't in Europe, so it doesn't work. But absolutely, why am I really interested in this data, and very kindly they give it to me, is because I'm really interested in where there isn't mobile phone usage, because then I can start to find those people who live on less than $1.9 a day and who won't have a smartphone and who won't be using things. And it's really interesting, in the World Bank you work alongside people who, they get found at about 17 years old, from countries where they get taken to 6 of the top universities, and they end up working for the bank. And I was with a fantastic guy from Latin America who was showing me that he'd given his father a mobile phone, and in his village, he was the only person going up and down his road, basically. There was no other usage at all, because there's no other mobile phones where he lives. What we're seeing is nations who you wouldn't have expected taking a real lead on this. And if you've never been on the Estonian e-residency site, it's worth having a look around, because they're very keen to give every world citizen a government-issued digital identity and the opportunity to run a trusted company online, unleashing the world's entrepreneurial potential. And it's amazing the number of people who I keep finding is going through this to set up entrepreneurial companies. And there's all kind of tax implications, I'm sure, that one day will get sorted, but... Anyway, at the moment, it's very entrepreneurial with people. We're seeing the Earth observation satellite industry is changing. It used to be made up of large satellites. They were, you know, the size and weight of buses. And they were revisiting once a day. Very high resolution, extremely expensive. Now, I don't know whether you know, but you have here, now in Scotland, 180 space-related companies. It's been the most fantastic investment by Scottish Enterprise. There is huge conglomerations of people coming, and you are one of the biggest builders now in Scotland for the world of small sats. Over in Glasgow, if you go and see them, they're sort of shoebox size. And time to development, months, and they make a difference. And so what we're seeing is people putting up flocks of these. You know, 150 went up last month. The biggest constraint is the launch vehicles, and you may have missed it, but in the Brexit announcements, that day when our Parliament announced Brexit was going ahead, there was only one other bill in the Queen's speech, and that was that we will have a spaceport here in England, Scotland and Wales, and it's likely to be possibly coming to Scotland. I have no idea, but either go there or to Cornwall or somewhere. So very exciting. But this is what organisations such as Airbus, who specialise at the moment in large satellites, are able the resolution. And here's Worldview 3 from Digital Globe, and you can see very high resolution data, and you can see car doors being opened. But they don't have the revisit time, and sometimes people, that's what people are interested in. They're also interested in, you know, how you can see different things happening, and being able to see, you know, Australian mine, for instance, what's happening here. You're looking at traffic and looking at supply chain analysis, looking at the traffic speed. Here is Aleppo, looking at what is happening for emergency response. So different satellites do different things at different times. We're also seeing something really amazing happening, which is that people are now quickly being able to integrate geospatial with the Internet of Things. And there are companies that are absolutely just pioneering through, growing so fast, and basically that are taking data and taking a billion pieces of data an hour into a system and geolocating. So, you know, it absolutely is blowing my head, but what I'm seeing is them being successful. We have here in Scotland, BirdEye, who's absolutely pioneered how to amalgamate so many different types of geospatial information into one very fast and start to analyse for construction sites remotely, so no longer do managers have to go out and visit them. They can just look at them through hourly satellite data. And what we're now seeing is commercial companies are building fleets of satellites to collect imagery. Additional companies are building businesses around the exploitation of these sensors, and IoT companies with the data analytics are joining with them. And so as a result, we're now seeing all of this coming together, and the key word is now very much the service people will give, rather than that technology piece I talked about earlier. What we're really seeing is everybody, just like we want software as a service, they're wanting geospatial as a service with answers. So one thing I thought might interest you is just showing how sometimes things get integrated. And this is something I mentioned that I was on the board of the Catapult. The Catapult is here to help everybody. It's here to help small businesses grow. It's help for new ideas, for people to come with new ideas and say, I've got a new idea, have you any funding that can help me get this going? And it's not, the Catapult is effectively not for profit, but it's there to grow this whole industry. So whether you're Sainsbury's who come to us, or whether you are somebody with a bright idea, we're very interested in this. One of the things that came was looking at illegal fishing. Because whether you are Sainsbury's, Waitrose, or whether you are wanting to protect your environment of your country, illegal fishing is a very big problem. And you may or may not know, taking that Internet of Things, there are now this identification technology on all ships of a certain size. And basically, if you know their location and their time and their behaviour, you and their identity, you can start to understand what they're up to. And let me just show you a quick video.
Illegal and unreported fishing can cost up to $23.5 billion a year. That's the equivalent of every one in five fish being caught illegally. It's a problem worth solving.
We've been set up to help businesses right across the economy make better use of space technology. As we were establishing ourselves, we realised there was an enormous appetite for better awareness of what was happening out on our oceans.
Pew Charitable Trust set themselves the goal of ending illegal fishing within 10 years. We've been working with Pew and their user communities to better understand what the problem is and how we can apply the technologies that we can bring to bear to help solve their problem.
any official in any port around the world should have access to enough information that they can make the right decision about a fishing vessel trying to enter their port and be aware of whether there's been any illegal activity in the history of that vessel. There's very few, if any, applications outside of the military where this level of data is brought into one place. Lots of this data already exists, but it's not being shared. And it's the power of sharing that data that will make the system work.
What we're seeing here is the global state of fishing. If an analyst or harbourmaster wishes to know the vessels operating in their area, they can view them in the list. If they wish to locate a specific vessel on the screen, say by name, by MMSI, the vessel's identifier, or by flag, the system can quickly filter the list, allowing easier analysis. The system can also bring up the history of a vessel, and in the background can gather and visualise the alerts that occurred along that track.
Previously, it took a team of analysts 18 hours or more to analyse the data and be able to find a vessel of interest. This system brings together all of those data sets in less than 18 milliseconds.
At some point on this journey, the vessel switched off and switched back on its AIS transponder. A notification of speed indicates that it was moving at a speed indicative of fishing. Vessels far from home often travel as part of a group. We can update the map. We can see the other vessels in the area of the same flag, each of them fishing vessels, and that they appear to be fishing in the same area. We can also show the topography of the ocean floor, which indicates the presence of seamounts and similar features. An experienced fisheries analyst can estimate the types of fish in such an area and cross-reference with the fishing licenses the vessel holds.
This big data analysis platform has been designed to support the fusion of large satellite data sets with a variety of supporting data. Data sets will include synthetic aperture radar, optical images, and infrared spectrum. As the system develops, machine learning algorithms will be applied to analyse vessel behaviour in real time. The software has been designed to be scalable from this virtual washroom right down to an individual sitting at the end of the port in a developing nation.
We have the platform that other people who are interested in what are going on in the oceans, they can use to look at new insurance modelling, new ways of modelling traffic flows in and out of maritime ports, and a vast array of other options, other ideas that people are having about how they can take advantage of better knowledge of what's going on in the oceans. This is all about space technology delivering benefit to real people in the real world right now.
So, just to finish, basically what I hope this has done is make you realise this is a growth industry. Many other industries are joining us, and you might be thinking, well, what's this then, another urban environment? No, that's a geospatial city. In China, they already have 25 of them. Each, you join the geospatial city if you are a new business, and every city has got about 1,000 businesses in it. So they are growing their businesses very strongly, as are we in this country. We really are growing tremendously over the last 2 or 3 years. And what we're seeing is investment going in. China has decided to build the Geospatial Conference Centre, which I'm told I will see this coming year. I and several others somehow managed to lay the original stone for it. I didn't know I was there for that, but it just happened on the side in one morning, which was a bit of a shock, really. But it shows that globally, this industry is very much growing, and I hope that this talk has opened your eyes to the importance of what you do if you're in it at the moment. If you're in another industry, come and join, because there are great jobs for every kind of person. We need everything from engineers right through to computer scientists to social scientists as well. And what we are very much seeing is that it underpins our lives here, underpins everybody's lives in their own nation, and hopefully will transform that dreadful situation that 10 times the population of the United Kingdom tonight are living on less than $1.9 a day, because where underpins all our daily lives. Thank you.
Questions?
Of any kind. I know I've spent some of the afternoon with with some of you talking about leadership, so taking those on your careers. Or... Hi, how was it?
You spent a whole lecture talking about how rotational information means to put good ends. But I felt like there's probably a lot that could be said about the dangers of gathering geospatial information, who it serves, can it be done badly, those kinds of questions.
Very good question. Now, I could have shown you quite a controversial video that you could have seen yourself on the BBC last week. I saw it just as a civilian, as you did. It was about 3.2-minute piece. Why do I say that? That was what happened in 3 minutes. So somebody here in the United Kingdom identified that somewhere in Raqqa, population was being gathered. Somewhere along the line, a van appeared, and they were able to identify, and these were from commercial satellites. These were not anything more than that. And they showed it on the BBC, so, you know, it's open information. They were able to see two people being led out. And they realised they were watching an execution. And very quickly they could identify a sharpshooter who was there to kill the civilians if they turned away from the execution of presumably their friends. And a drone was deployed and killed the sharpshooter and killed the people, and the civilians are seen going away. And now safe. So, you know, of course, you could turn that round. It's well known that enemies have geospatial information as well. It's very well known, unfortunately. But it's being used a lot in development to help people. I don't know, we all have our views on whether that execution should have gone ahead. From my point of view, thank goodness it didn't. And other people were saved from, you know, an ISIS end. But though, you know, so it is used in different ways. But it's like many things. I once, in my professional life, had somebody tell me that high-quality data should be stopped being given out. And then I was able to be reminded, I gave them the view. I said, when Mrs. Thatcher was in power, very sadly, a rocket was fired into number 10 from Downing Street, from Whitehall. And it was in a Mini Cooper, where somebody had driven the Mini Cooper up, opened the sunshine roof, put the rocket out, and fired it. And, you know, that's a real life thing. And on the back seat were the detailed ordnance survey maps. Now, Ordnance Survey underpins £100 billion of the British economy. If those had been stopped at some point for just stopping that one person, would that have helped? Would you have the detail of our utilities, the assistance you have with your mobile phone signals, and all of these things? So, of course, like many things, they can be used for good and for evil. But I think overall, I would go there for good.
Okay, but that doesn't really talk about how we should be stewarding that information. And so, are we happy with Uber having the level of information about our lives that they do, and the way that gives them power to shape the cities that we live in ways that we might not like? Or another example from your talk is that Rwandan registration of land, I sort of started to wonder how do you know that the people who were being through the land was being registered to own the land in the first place?
So, okay. Good, very good point. So let me reassure you about the Rwandan one. The way it was done, very innovative, was to give the women universally in villages
handheld GPS, and they walked around and they basically plotted and discussed with people what do you own, where do you own it. And then the maps were made, and then they were put up for public consultation. And people went, oh, I don't think you do. And then officials came in and dealt with the disputes. So in Rwanda, I think it was helpful. This collection of our stuff that goes on when we don't know about it, I think is something that over time, just like we're seeing people becoming more conscious about the whole, you know, what we put on the internet, what we put on social media, I'm sure over time there will be more controls on it. I'm confident on that. You know, at the moment, everyone's learning. You know, you put up, if I showed you the interactiveness of some of the stuff, you know, you'd go, crikey, I didn't know you could do that. And the regulators, the people who will oversee this, they're just beginning to make those policies. Remember, we're only really at the tip. And, you know, remember those of us at the very beginning of the internet, you know, passwords were, you know, we just didn't have anything secure. And, you know, everybody's Wi-Fi was open to everybody and things like that. And then we've started to learn what are the better protocols. And over time, we will learn those. But, you know, we also must be aware of this is going on. So, you know, Yes, well, also be careful with your location services. You know, do you want to be known? You know, or, you know, it's just like WhatsApp. You see, when did somebody last look at their WhatsApp? And it's 3:30 in the morning, you kind of go, oh, I wonder what, they were pretty late to bed last night, you know. So there's a whole lot of information you find out, which you don't intend to find out now. And that's in the digital era. But would I go backwards and say don't have it? Probably not.
Nearing drinks time. You are most welcome to come for drinks, but we can hang around and chat for a bit afterwards. But no more questions? Final question.
One of the things you talked about was about the sort of official schemes of land registry in developing countries. What do you think about sort of the alternatives of crowdsourced methods, sort of like OpenStreetMaps, has been used in sort of like voluntary hazard mapping, and also services like What3Words,
yep,
to allow people to give themselves an address, rather than sort of these top-down approaches?
I think in many of the countries I work in, so let's sort of think about, we've got about 194 to 196 official countries. A couple that can come in and come out of being official, and I'm not going to go to those. And then we sort of say, attending the United Nations now, there are about 140 who attend the UN and say, hey, I want to be part of the geospatial community at my ministerial level. And then you say, and how many have got up-to-date, reliable, state-driven mapping? And you are really, I don't even need to take my shoes and socks off, frankly. You know, up-to-date and maintained mapping is not something that many countries have at state-driven level. Many aspire to it, but they haven't got it. Or there's been massive underinvestment, or they try to do it differently with satellite imagery and things like that. And then you look at the rest, so probably for over 100 countries, for sure, then absolutely, the kind of informal mapping has to be the answer. And, you know, so I think it's a mix of all things. You know, I'm a tremendous supporter, and two of my godchildren actually are running one of the humanitarian OpenStreetMap sessions. They run the Cambridge Cell. And, you know, they get about 140 people coming every time, and it's growing. And they're of every kind of background. And, you know, they've just sent me what's happening on the 10th of October. I've never actually been to one of their meetings, but, you know, I get to hear and I send it to more people. And that's great, because then they're doing stuff on South Sudan. and I have to say that's fantastic. So, you know, absolutely. I think it's, it all goes alongside. And just at this moment, of course, we've just seen with Hurricane Irma, you know, the geography of the Caribbean has changed beyond belief. And the more people that can help get those foundation layers rebuilt, Map Action's been doing a fantastic job. And it was being used. I received an email from one of the major nation saying, hey, you introduced us to Map Action a few years ago, and my goodness, we just want to tell you that our official people are using it because it was a new geography, and that's what they needed. So I think there's space for us all. You can't do enough to get this geospatial foundation layers built and then maintained. The maintenance is the number one thing. You can't keep it, 40, 50 years ago. And what three words has got a great place in many nations. There's no addressing system, or it's a crackpot addressing system that nobody can understand. And, you know, if that's going to mean people can now have an address and an informal settlement, that's great. But, you know, it does need to be adopted by somebody. It can't just be, you know, we can't have technology leading. We have to have customers for it. So, you know, if the nation wants to be the customer, great. And I know Mongolia has. And my colleagues in Mongolia are quite delighted with that. That's great.
Great questions, I think. Any more? Or if it's not us? I think as it's approaching drinks time and you travel this way, I will maybe leave it in a moment. But yes, great questions. I'm not going to talk about that, so we'll chip in. Thank you all.